Alive. David, I'm a bit disappointed that you were not drinking a pure original coffee. That was the only thing. But all right, okay. What coffee is it? I mean, don't you have some real Italian one?
No, unfortunately, I'm stuck with drip filter coffee, American style.
All right.
This is what we drink over here, unfortunately.
Where are you now?
I'm in Boston.
Okay.
Yeah, my lab is at this place. So I'm just at home.
How is the situation now with the Biden victory?
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who are happy. I'm in Massachusetts, the state of Massachusetts, so there are a lot of happy people around here. I'm a scientist, so, you know, I like people who believe in science and facts.
Right.
That's my leaning. In terms of the pandemic, you know, my lab is still on shift work. I actually went into my lab for the first time yesterday and got my pink armband to let me in. But I'm considered non-essential staff, so I don't get to go in very often. But it was really great to go in and see everybody.
How does it work, the testing? I mean, do you need to do a test to go into the lab? They test your temperature. How does it work there?
Well, we have testing that's provided for free by the university, which is good. But we also we do a self questionnaire that on your phone, and you have to swear that you haven't been near a patient or someone who has COVID, etc.
Got it.
Not feeling sick, and you sign that every time you go in.
Got it.
But yeah, we still have to keep big distances. We can't gather in rooms. We have benches in what we call bays, and you can only let one person in there at a time. And science is a very social endeavor, and being with masks and separated and shift work, yeah, it's really not the same. It's very hard to do science at a world-class level under these conditions.
Yeah, I can imagine that. It would be interesting, a study about this period and the impact on scientific research in general caused by the distancing and all the difficulties of the period. That would be interesting to see one day.
Yeah, well, that's the downside that I've told you about. But there's an upside to this, which is that scientists have rallied against the virus. And we're collaborating a lot more than we used to, though most of it's through this kind of a chat. But I think most people are less competitive these days. But I'm sure once we get through the pandemic, scientists being scientists will go back to being, you know, relatively selfish in their endeavors. A lot of them. By the way, that's not our fault. The system is set up to be selfish. You know, winner takes all in science. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know what is interesting, David? This morning I had a live interview with an Italian professor, psychology professor, and they did a big research for the last 5-6 months trying to understand the reaction of Italian citizens to science. So the big question was, do Italian citizens trust science now, more or less? And the incredible thing to me was seeing a chart where basically the confidence of Italians towards science, I don't know how you say in English, I mean the confidence for science is going down. Like people start to say, yeah, you know, that's it, enough. And I didn't understand if it's a matter of that the cure is not there yet, or you know, just people they are tired about the lockdown, because in Italy you have some part of the country in lockdown. I don't know, but it's a difficult period that for someone who loves science, like myself and yourself, it's tricky to see, you know, why people shouldn't have confidence in science, you know. But I don't know, how do you see this situation?
Well, it's troubling because our civilization is built on scientific discovery. You know, if all we did was wishful thinking and praying, which people are welcome to do, but we would still be in the Middle Ages, you know, probably, you know, even further back. So science has brought us out of misery and disease and suffering, and to abandon it is craziness. You know, our civilization cannot hold together unless we all agree that there are some facts and that we can use science to understand how things work and make life better. I think part of the problem is social media, right? People can have their own facts, seemingly. But also it's become politicized. You see in Britain, in the US, that politicians get people riled up, as we say, because, you know, just by saying scientists are wrong, you know, some people, you know, love that kind of a fight. But, you know, a famous person once said, everyone is entitled to their own opinions, but not to their own facts. And I subscribe to that. But, you know, unfortunately, scientists, at least during this period of history, people are losing faith in it. And I just think it's a dangerous precedent, because if you can't trust scientists, honestly, who can you trust?
Absolutely. And also for me, David, it's funny to see that people who complain about science do it on a technology made thanks to science, using smartphones made thanks to science. You know, it's everything based on science, scientific discoveries, and they complain about it. So it's this big paradox. But anyway, I didn't want to take you on this field. I was just curious about your opinion, because it is a weird period, really. But I want to talk about aging, of course, which is your topic, is the your book, translated it also into Italian. So very, very interesting. Number one, I have to say that you keep getting younger, David. I don't know what you're doing, but when I see an interview, I mean, you keep getting younger and younger. I don't know if you have a secret that you keep for yourself, but every year I think, wow, David is younger now this year. You know, so I want the same recipe.
Thanks. That's kind of you. But first of all, I don't agree. I can see.
All right.
But I don't have a secret. I actually, in my book, I divulge everything that I do and my father does. But maybe something's working. You know, I'm still 51, so it's a bit early to say for sure that I'm out of the norm. But my father is 81, and at 81, he is fitter, stronger, happier, more sociable than I am. And he started a new career in his 70s, and he doesn't feel any disease. He has no pain. He's walking 10 miles a day. He's if anything is showing that what I'm saying could work, it's him.
And he's following a specific diet, a specific regime. So he's following something that is based on your research.
Yes. I mean, he and I, we live normal lives. We're not, you know, fanatical about it. We eat relatively normal food. But what we do is, well, totally normal food. We try to focus on plant foods and not eat too much every meal. But one of the things that he and I have done for at least a decade is we try to skip at least one meal a day. And it's been shown. Volta Longo is well known in Italy for his work on fasting, intermittent fasting. And we all agree as scientists that this is healthy. Now, you know, not for young kids, not malnutrition, not starvation, of course, but certainly in middle age and later in life, it's a real problem eating three full meals a day and snacking and never feeling any hunger. You know, instead, what I do is I have a coffee or a tea. I miss breakfast. I try to skip lunch if I'm busy and I don't care. Probably I'd eat lunch every second day and then eat a normal dinner with some red wine. But that I think
Italian, David, Italian red wine.
I do love Italian red wine. Whatever I can get my hands on, to be honest. But there's moving.
Screw top.
Yeah. My family and I, we love Italy. Rome, we've been to many times. Fasting is good. Exercise, everyone talks about. But there are certain types of exercise that are better than others. There's high-intensity interval training. You want to lose your breath.
Sorry, David, before to go into exercise, let me stay for a second about intermittent fasting and food. It's interesting for me because I do intermittent fasting now for, I don't know, I'm 48. I'm almost 50 now. So yeah, I'm 48 and something. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I didn't think that at all. So you're dead.
You thought I was like 47. You know, when someone wanted to make a compliment and say, well, no, really, you are. So anyway, I'm almost 50 and I'm doing intermittent fasting. And I'm the funny thing for me is that I tried, I was not interested at all about aging when I was, you know, in my 20s. I thought, yeah, who cares? And now that I'm, you know, getting to the 50s, I think, well, what should I do, you know? So anyway, intermittent fasting, I'm doing it. And I was always able to skip breakfast, always. But I remember that I was forced in Italy to eat breakfast because everyone say, hey, you have to eat breakfast to be stronger. So I was always eating breakfast. I mean, my wife say, oh, why don't you eat breakfast? Like, it's a bad thing. And now that intermittent fasting is out there, I say, guys, you see that I was not so wrong. So I see a lot of people. I also interview Wim Hof, and he said, you know, I just eat once a day or something like that. So I see a lot of this movement growing. So I'm happy to see that it's not only in my head or my habit, but has got a scientific reason. But why does it work? This is what I don't understand.
Oh, well, we know quite a lot about that. Our body just relaxes when there's no threats. There's a term called hormesis, which means what doesn't kill you makes you stronger and longer lived. And we have these genes in our bodies. There are three main sets of genes. I work on one set called sirtuins. There are others, one called AMPK, another one mTOR. And these are genes that respond to adversity or threats to survival. So what's the worst we can do to make sure that they don't protect us? Sit down, eat a lot of food, don't lift anything heavy, don't eat foods that are from stressed plants, because plants, when they are also under adversity, we think they signal our body with molecules like resveratrol from red wine. So a lot of what we do now is we have plants that are super healthy in greenhouses. We sit down all day and we eat whenever we want. These protective pathways are switched off and we age faster. This is the problem. Modern life is killing us. But there's ways to make the body fight back. And that's why exercise, being hungry, and eating foods of certain types are what will activate these genetic defenses. Now, how do they work? That would take, you know, another few hours. Or yeah. In my book, I explain why and how that we think they work. But essentially they're like the Pentagon in the US. They sense a threat and they send out the troops to protect the body.
Got it. By the way, let me tell the name of your book in Italian. Do you know what's the title of your book in Italian or
I've
not?
Forgotten. I did approve the cover, but I think it was, I really liked it.
So Camilla is helping us, says the Italian version is called Longevità. Longevity, yeah, longevità, and perché vecchiamo, perché non dobbiamo farlo. So why why we age and why we don't have to? So thanks to Camilla, but it's a great word. Longevità is a great word in Italian. And about fasting, my second question was, should I fast one day, intermittent fasting? Should I add an extra one day full fasting? Should I go for longer period? Because I read about Longo saying, you know, the different system to do this fasting. So what do you suggest?
Okay, so the scientific fact is that we don't know what's optimum, but I would say even a little bit will help. But there are a few different types. So it sounds like you and I do what's called a 16-8.
Yeah.
Right. So it's try to fast for 16 hours if you can, including sleep. There's another version, which is don't eat for 2 days. So that's the 5-2 method, which I don't do because I find it's too difficult for me. But a lot of people do that. Try not to eat on the weekend or whatever. If you can go for at least 2 days, and even better if you can do 3, I think. I think that's probably going to have better effects in the long run, because there's a type of cleaning out of the body called autophagy, which there are two levels of autophagy. Right. There's just the normal level, which is macro autophagy, and then there's this other, there's micro
the
and
pro level.
What's that?
Like the pro level, the level.
Yeah, it is the real deep cleaning, and that gets activated after 2 or 3 days of hunger. And so, right. Yeah, you and I don't know if you've gone for 2 days. Have you tried going for
no,
longer?
No, 2 days, no. It's out of my pay grade, I think, above my pay grade. But I try 1 day. It's hard. Just 16:8, easy. But if I go 1 day, you know what? I start to be very cold when I don't eat. Like I'm cold, properly cold. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's a symptom of this. We drink some hot tea or whatever, but you know, I'm with you. I find it's hard to go for longer. There's a doctor here in the US, Peter Attia. Sounds Italian to me. He goes sometimes for a week without eating, probably four times a year, something like that. And I think that would be great if you could do it.
Got it.
And so there's different levels. But the bottom line with my book is what I say is don't give up on anything, right? Try it a little bit. And often these things, you have to get used to it. Initially, if you try to skip breakfast and lunch, you will feel like it's too much. So to start with a little bit, you know, every other day, try to have a small breakfast if you are used to it. But the other thing that's important is that everybody's different. And what works perfectly for me and my father may not feel good for someone else. You know, my wife needs to have breakfast every day. Well, she's German, but yeah. Dinner for her is not as important. And so you could vary how you do your fasting.
That's a good point. If my wife doesn't eat breakfast, she will kill me. So I prefer that she eat breakfast, but I prefer to live, you know. But I agree, it's different. Everyone different. My other question was before going about into the movement, let's say, section. Sometimes when I read about aging, or I watch your interviews, or try to go try to understand a bit more about this topic, what I don't understand is the following. On one side, I can do, you know, good eating, eating not too much, good exercise, good mindset, you know, Italian style, let's say, in a good way. On the other side, my thinking is, all right, I will age anyway, and I will die, but you know, I will age a little bit slower. That's what in my head. The other option is it anything that I can do to be younger, you know, to get younger, to go back in time a little bit? So this is the question.
Well, okay, so 10 years ago I would have said going back in age is impossible,
right,
with technology that we know about. I totally changed my mind on that, because we've seen, actually, at least in animals and a little bit in some human studies, that first of all, we can now accurately measure the clock of aging. It has a particular name called the DNA methylation clock, or the Horvath clock, named after my good friend Steve Horvath. We can now measure that. So we can tell if you do something and aging goes backwards now. Other, you know, before we would say, oh, do you look a bit younger? That's not science, right?
Yeah.
So what we've seen in animals, first of all, is that there are some treatments. There was one early this year in rats that reversed the age of those rats. In some tissues in the rat by 70-something percent, on average 50%. It was with a blood treatment with some factors. In humans, there's some evidence that they've gone back 2 years roughly, but it's only 2 years. Now, you can think of it like, oh, it's only 2 years, or you can think, if I get an extra 2 years of healthy life,
wow,
that's a great thing. But it's early days in humans. But in mice, let me tell you and everyone who's listening, watching here, is that we have a study that's about to come out probably next month that will show that it's a fact that you can reverse the age in a mouse with only 3 weeks of treatment. And we decided to reverse the age of the eye. And when we did that, the old mice could see again. The blind mice could see again.
Wow.
And so that's just the eye. And I think in the future, we'll be able to reverse whole organs as well as potentially the whole body. So we're working on that. And there's a growing movement. It's called epigenetic rejuvenation or epigenetic resetting. Reprogramming is another way. And it's a whole new area of aging research that I'm really excited about.
That's incredible. But what is, David, the holy grail of this? What will make things dramatically different and will allow to reverse or rejuvenate?
Okay, so we don't know for sure if it's perfectly safe. So we need to prove that. Both in animals and then in humans. But we're optimistic because we've treated mice for 15 months, over a year, and there's no downside that we can see. They have less cancer, if anything. So we're optimistic. We're going to do clinical trials in the eye in humans if everything goes to plan in 2 years from now, maybe sooner. We've been working on this for at least a year. But the big obstacle besides safety is how do you deliver this? It's a genetic reprogramming. It's a gene therapy. So we have to deliver these genes currently. So one obstacle is getting it into the body. We have a way to turn it on and off with just taking an antibiotic called doxycycline. So that's all ready to go. It's just getting it evenly. Even in a mouse, turns out you cannot evenly get a gene therapy. It goes to the liver mostly. For example, but technology is changing quickly, so I think that's going to happen. The big breakthrough will be not if, but when somebody figures out how to recapitulate these changes with a pill, because gene therapy will always be hard and more expensive than a pill. And there are a few labs in the world that are working on that, including mine.
Oh, that would be incredible. That would be like the movie that I recently watched, Project Power, where you get a pill. And I don't know if you watched it on Netflix. It's Jamie Foxx. And there is a pill, and they eat this pill, and then they have a superpower. But they don't know what the superpower is. So it's all based on this, you know. But you get the pill, and boom, superpower. Wow, that's fantastic. And what about the funding? Because I think you recently said that there is not so much funding. You don't have, you know, an incredible amount of money to test all of the variations that should be important to do. And in my head, I thought, how is that possible? I mean, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, and a lot of billionaires out there, they are 90 plus. They should be really interested in this topic. Why are they not investing, you know, billions and billions on this?
It often comes as a surprise to non-scientists that, first of all, the university doesn't pay us anything in the lab, so we have to bring in outside money. Most of our money comes from the government, which it takes a year at least to get money from having the idea. And these grants, you can hire maybe a couple of people. So it's real small scale. You know, my lab is fortunate. We have a few donations a year, relatively small ones, but nothing that can allow me to relax. You know, I wake up every morning worried about where are we going to get the money to do things, pay the scientists, pay the students. I have to pay my students as well. This is the life of a scientist, even in this topic of aging. And I think one of the obstacles to people donating to aging is that it could be seen as a selfish pursuit. But the truth is it's the opposite. If we can keep people healthier for longer across the planet, it will save trillions of dollars per year. And every day we're losing about 100,000 people. So, you know, even a minor advance would greatly improve people's lives. And we're also not talking about making people older for longer. We're talking about keeping people disease-free.
That's a good point.
The goal of all medical research, isn't it? It's just that this could have a big impact, not just on one disease, but on the top five diseases on the planet.
That's a good point, David, because often when I talk with some older people, and it's also funny, I was thinking, to me, 20 years ago, 40 years old was really old. Like when I thought, oh, when I'll be old at 40, and now I think when I'll be old at 80, you know, I try to keep moving this age. Now, often the idea is, I don't want to live longer, because the idea is that then you live in pain for a longer period of time. But if you can be healthy, I mean, it's a different game. So, yeah. But do you think that we'll be able to arrive at a point where, at a certain point where you are maybe 80 with some problems and you can get some kind of treatment that rejuvenates your body and helps you to be pain free? Is a possible scenario, this one?
Yes, certainly. The biology and the science says it's going to be possible. Can we do it today and rejuvenate a human? Not really. We have some molecules that in the field that we work on. I work on a molecule called NAD, which in animals can rejuvenate their muscle. They can run 50% further after 3 weeks of treatment. So if that works in humans, that would be a big deal. There are some drugs on the market for other diseases. There's one called metformin for type 2 diabetes, rapamycin for mostly tumor and also immune suppression. These two drugs in animals can extend lifespan, and they're on the market for humans. And in the case of metformin, people have studied 10,000 or more people who've taken this drug for their diabetes, and they also seem to have less cancer, heart disease, frailty. So that we already have potentially the tools to do this. Now, will metformin make you suddenly young? No. But what it could do is give you another 5 years of youthfulness and pain-free life if you start early enough.
Got it. About movement, David, I always have a discussion with my friends. They are my age, and I have two categories of friends. One category are the fitness fanatic. They do marathons. They swim in the ocean. They do any kind of crazy thing. They will do it. And they every day exercise fitness, like until they are dead, basically. They arrive at the end. They can't even move. All right. And then I have another category of friends. Are the British drinkers and party, you know, that say, all right, that's it. You know, I'm 50. Who cares? You know, so, and I cannot find myself in these two categories because they're two fanatics. I don't know. So movement, I was a professional table tennis player until 25 years old, and I killed my body. So by practicing every day, you know, so, I see what happens if you practice hard every day, 6 hours a day movement, your body, it's not getting better after a while. So what is the limit of the movement? What is the right dose of movement and the right kind of movement that you see in your research? Was it a stupid question, David?
No, it's a very good question. And it's a tough question to answer because there are some downsides to exercising that much, particularly with running. And of course, contact sports, we all know the problems. I'm like you. I think something in between is probably the healthiest. But reading other people's research who study cyclists and runners, their chance of dying at later ages, I think, let's say it was 80 by recollection, is 40% less than someone who doesn't exercise. So any exercise is great for you. It doesn't seem like you can really overdo it unless you injure yourself.
Right.
You have to be careful not to get inflamed joints. But otherwise, as long as you're not having too much impact on your body, cycling, whatever these people are doing, I think it was 60 kilometers a day or more, doesn't seem to be a problem. In fact, it seems to help. But the good news is it's a curve. You know, I'm a scientist. I'll draw it. You get very big benefits, even with a little bit. And then, the more you do, it's not the same. So what I try to do is do a little bit of exercise each week for a couple of days, run, lose my breath, you know that you're doing the right amount when you cannot carry out a conversation. You're like that. But yeah, I hate exercise, to be honest. But what I do like is lifting weights. I like the feeling of being strong. So I do that instead. And I do that a few times a week. And I find that helps. I'm, you know, an older male, so keeps testosterone up, which is good for muscle and all sorts of good things. And then, you know, it also raises metabolism. So I don't have to worry so much about eating a large dinner.
Yeah, that's a good point. By the way, John, totally unrelated, just wrote, David Sinclair does not speak with an Aussie accent. Where did he train? That's an interesting random question while we were going into the depth of aging.
Well, I can speak Australian if you want. G'day, mate. How's it going? But I've never been asked that, but I'll tell you, I've been out of Australia for 25 years. But I grew up in a part of Sydney that doesn't have a strong accent. And the third thing that most people don't know about me, because it's not that interesting, is I spent a year in Cardiff, Wales. And there I learned to speak more British. And that might be what people hear.
That's incredible. I lived in Brighton in UK for 8 years, and I still speak the same horrible English with an Italian accent and bad grammar. So it's for some people, it's just impossible. But I was curious, David, instead, how did you start studying aging? It was something that since you were a little kid said, I want to be an aging expert when I'm older, or is something that just happened, and how?
Well, I've always wanted to do science. I just like discovering things, and I'm very curious. And my parents were biologists. They would talk about, well, they were biochemists at a pathology company, so they talked about urine, feces at the dinner table. So this was my upbringing. And I lived on the edge of a big forest, the Australian bush, and I would go walking there. So I was very much interested in animals. So I didn't want to study aging from an early age, but I was bothered by it. My grandmother, who helped raise me, she was a very young grandmother. She was in her 40s, having had my father at age 15. So she was more like a mother to me, second mother. But she was very brutal in honesty. She told me that at the age of 4 that everybody dies. My pets will die. My cat will die. She will die. I will die. And at 4, that's really hard to absorb. I was raised on Disney movies, and nothing really bad happens in Disney movies except in Bambi. So I was in shock, and I think that was the start of it. But I do remember in my early teens, being quite depressed, as a lot of teenagers get, not clinically depressed, but just sad at the thought that we are a conscious animal, knowing that we will die. And that's a real burden on an animal a being. And most animals, I think probably all animals, don't really have this burden of knowing what's coming. And as a result, you know, we have ways of coping. There's religion, of course, that helps, but there's also denial. And probably because of my grandmother, I couldn't deny the fact. It's been on my mind that my grandmother would die. That turned out to happen. My parents would die. My mother has passed away. And it's not anything you want to witness.
Yeah.
I don't think it's anything you want to happen to yourself either. It can be painful. It's degrading. I watched my mother suffocate to death in front of me with my brother and father. These are things that are horrible, but we deny that these things will happen, often until it's too late, right? It's only till you get to your 50s do you think, oh, crap, you know, this is going to happen. But I started studying aging when I was in my early 20s, thinking about maybe I could have an impact, not so much making us live, you know, another 100 years or anything, that's just fantasy, but more about, can I leave an impact on the planet in a good way? Can I leave the world a better place than I found it?
And if someone today want to study aging and anti-aging, what is the best path to follow? Where are the best experts in the world, or best kind of universities, or what would you recommend?
Yeah, well, this field is exploding, so it's a great time to get into it. You know, when I started 25 years ago, it was considered the worst part of biology. There wasn't a lot of good science being done. Now it's the cutting edge, top scientists. There's been two Nobel Prizes awarded for research that's related to aging, maybe a third one if you count reprogramming, which I talked about. If you're in high school, I would start by reading about it, not just the stuff on the internet randomly, but there are some good scientific papers you can find. There are good books that have been written by Volta Longo, Lifespan. My book is very a good primer about how the field is developing. People in college, I would say, try to get a degree that includes molecular biology, genetics, genomics, the cutting edge technologies. And interestingly, bioinformatics computing is increasingly essential for not just aging, but biology in general.
But is there a country that is far ahead? Or like, I don't know, the Chinese lab hidden somewhere that is...
maybe, not that I know of. The US is always a leader because they have so many labs and they have more money into biology than any other country. The other hotspots, UK, Italy. And Italy is great because they have these centenarian collections, people who tend to live over 100. Other hotspots, you know, China is catching up, but still they're not really there. Japan has been leading Asia for quite a while. I think they will catch up, the Chinese, but it's been surprising how slow they've been to work on aging, because they have this aging population and it's going to crush them economically unless they figure something out.
What do you think about these Italian centenaries, David? Because on Italian media from time to time, you read the news. Oh, he died at the age of 110 and his secret was that he was drinking 3 bottles of wine every day, you know. So there are all of these legends. At the end, you don't know why. Is the culture, is the food, is the... I don't know. So is there any more research about it that is real data, real research, apart from the legends?
Yeah, it's been really hard to figure out why these people live so long. You would think you would just look at what they do and look at their genes and you'd have the answer. It turns out not to be that simple. There are some genes that long-lived families have, not genes, but gene variants, that allows them to resist the effects of smoking and overeating. But in general, these are people who are not hugely overweight, have done a lot of exercise, have not had a lot of stress, eat the right types of foods generally. But there are always exceptions. Our Nir Barzilai, who also has a book this year called Age Later, he talks about his centenarian families in New York. And typically, these centenarians haven't lived a perfect life in terms of lifestyle, but they haven't abused their bodies typically either. So that it seems like they can lead an average life, eating well, in some cases even smoking, but their genetics is helping them. But there's also there's a third factor, which is luck, right? If you take
that's a good point.
Billion people, there will be some in that tail of the curve. There's always this tail of people who live longer than you would think, and those are the lucky ones. And it may just be like asking, how do you win the lottery? By studying lottery winners. That doesn't help. But there are some genes that there's one called FOXO, there's one called SERT1, which we study, that you can have variants that give you an edge. But here's the interesting thing, Marco, is that only 20% of your longevity can be attributable attributable to genetics.
Got it.
And we know that because there are studies of twins that live different lives, and they're identical genetically, but they live different, have different lifespans and health. What's the rest? The rest is epigenetics, which is what I think is a major driver of the aging process and allows us to reset the body. And the epigenetics is what controls the genes, whether they're on or off, what your mother did when she was pregnant with you, and what you do in your life when you fast, you change that that process. And that's 80%. And so that's good news. That means you can have a big impact on late life if you start early and slow down that process.
Because I was thinking, if genetic was very, very important, maybe getting those centenaries, extracting, like in the movies, the genes, the good genes, and inserting the gene like Mission Impossible into the other, the human beings, and that's it, problem solved. But yeah. But what about wine? I mean, sorry for the stupid question, but everyone say, yeah, but you know, a glass of red wine is really good for your age. There's something in Italy is like the truth, you know, is a fact. But is a fact, or is just bullshit and is just to sell some wine?
I don't think it's bullshit.
Right.
I have studied resveratrol since 2002 and found that it directly turns on one of these protective enzymes. I mentioned it earlier, SIRT1. And this is known in people, or at least it's believed, to give you an edge over Alzheimer's disease and heart attacks. Now, red wine has a small amount of resveratrol in it, but it also has other molecules called in the family called polyphenols. There's one called quercetin as well. And there's alcohol in it as well, which in small doses is beneficial. So it's not crazy to say that a glass of red wine a day with full of these molecules can be beneficial. Interestingly, a lot of long-lived people do drink red wine in Europe. The longest-lived French woman and longest-lived human on record, Jeanne Calment. So she lived to 122. In Italy, a 116-year-old man, Antonio Todd, I think he still holds the record, actually, for man.
Right.
He drank red wine every day too. So this doesn't prove anything, but our work does show that there are molecules in red wine that over long periods of time, you know, one drink's not going to make you live longer, but 3 decades of a glass every day or other day, I think it could really help.
Interesting. So for the people watching the video, no, one bottle a day is not good. Let's say that. No, it's just, we're talking about a glass, not one bottle. One bottle a day is not good. But what is the life expectancy in this moment? And how fast is, I don't know how you say in English, how fast is growing? How many months or we are adding every year to life expectancy? If we talk in 20 years, there will be a difference. It will be the same. It will be longer, shorter.
Yeah. Well, so speaking about developed countries only, so Europe, US, parts of Asia, the figure that is often quoted, and I reference it in my book, is every year that you stay alive, you get another 3 months of life because technology is improving.
Mm.
And so the goal in part is, if you want to live a long time, live longer because technology is improving. Yeah,
1 year to achieve the 1 year every year. So
exactly. Well, yeah, immortality, exactly. Yeah. We're not there yet, but the average lifespan is going up. Now, there are some, of course, some exceptions. 1918 was an exception. It dipped. Probably, you know, 2020 is going to be an exception. But over the long course of the 20th century and 21st century, it's a very linear increase in the maximum average human lifespan. So what we do is we plot which country has the best average lifespan. And right now it's Japan, which is 80, 3, I think. In the US, it's high 70s. Probably in Italy, I would imagine it's close to 80. Australia's doing pretty well, 81, I think, for females at least. But it keeps going up. That's the point. And it's been linear for the last 50 years. And every time somebody says that it cannot go higher, it goes higher. So it's hard to, you know, argue against technological changes that are going. But we've done all the easy stuff. You know, we've allowed us to mostly survive childhood and our 70s. Now we're into our 80s. But what we know is that human beings can live to 110, 100, and even 20. That's at least, you know, another 40 years we could give ourselves at a minimum if we could all live like those people.
On this topic, David, I read once about Ray Kurzweil, that he was taking pills every day and like supplements. I don't know if it's true or not. I mean, that was the article. And the idea behind was trying to get to a certain point when then, you know, that kind of balance, immortality balance will magically appear and he will be basically living forever. That was I said it in a bad way, but I was shocked by the amount of supplements that he was getting. So I was curious about your opinion about the use of supplements and all this work.
Well, I take a few supplements, and in my book, it's on page 304, if anyone wants to jump to the cheat sheet, as I call it.
The list.
There's a list, yeah, of what my father and I do, and I know people wanted to know that, so I'm happy to say what I do. I don't take a lot of things. I'm not like Ray. I'm not popping pills, a lot of pills. I choose them wisely. So why do I do that? Because every molecule can have a downside. You know, even if it's something as simple as resveratrol, if you take it at high doses, it can affect the kidneys, we think. And maybe taking handfuls of pills could be damaging the liver or the kidney ultimately. So I'm selective. But I also, what I do that I think is important is I measure parameters in my blood. You know, not so much during the pandemic, but I used to measure it a few times a year and also plug those data into a program that tells me how I'm doing compared to other people.
Right.
And so I know with my body, if I take a new supplement, if it's doing good or it's doing harm or has no effect, and I just add things on usually one by one that way. But yeah, I think supplements are okay. There's no proof for supplements at this point. But if we wait for proof, you and I will be dead, or at least too old to benefit. So you have to weigh up the risk-reward. And one thing that I think we should all admit is that we know what's going to happen if we don't do anything, right? And it's not pretty. Same with our parents and grandparents. So with that in mind, you know, a supplement or two, as long as it's from a reputable supplier and it's pure, I think for me, the risk is worth taking, because the alternative is not good either.
Yeah, but you say something that made me think. How do you track your aging? Because, for instance, I told you, oh, you look younger, and you say, oh, Monty, you look younger. But then maybe my body inside is super old. I don't know, but I don't see it from outside. Is it any way to track your aging level that normal people, without being a scientist, that we could do?
There are. Now, there are different levels of testing. The easiest is just to ask how many push-ups can you do. And
right.
People who are our age typically cannot even do 10. If you can do 20, you're doing well. But that, of course, depends on practice. There's another test that is good, which is you sit down with your legs crossed and then try to get up without touching your hands on the floor.
Right.
And if you can do that, you're in very good shape. Most 50-year-olds cannot do that. They have to push up with a hand.
Right. And oh, my goodness. I can't wait to do the test. All right.
It's really hard because our muscles are losing strength all the time at our age. An older person in their 60s will often have to get onto one knee to get up. And so that's an easy test. Everyone can do that, you know, today. There's another test which is a little bit more difficult, but you can. There are companies that do this. So the company that I use is called Inside Tracker. And if you don't have it in Europe, you can actually upload your blood tests, get a doctor to do the blood test. Inside Tracker over here, and I'm a consultant and an investor in this company. I have to disclose, I want to disclose. But what they do is they send a nurse or a phlebotomist to the house, or you can have a test and then you get the results back. And what they tell you is, here's your optimal range for this measurement. They take about 35 measurements. And this is a graph on how you're doing.
Right.
And I've been doing that for 11 years, and I've been optimizing my body as best I can. How old am I? Well, they calculated that last time I did it, really, I was down to 30 years of age by their measurements. So that's promising. There's a new test which I want to tell you about quickly. Is that, remember I said the epigenome is important for aging? And in our paper that's coming out in December, we show that we can reset the epigenome, basically push the reset button and restore the hard drive or restore the software. You can measure the epigenetic changes. There's a particular one called DNA methylation, and this is just a chemical that gets added to our DNA as we get older and subtracted. And you can measure those. And if you plug that data into a computer, it can tell you your biological age. And some people are much older or younger than their actual birthday candles. And it correlates. If you don't look after your body, typically you'll be older and vice versa. And you can predict when you're going to die based on that data. Due to the pandemic, I haven't done this yet. I want to do it because it's quite an accurate measure.
Interesting. Can you repeat me the name of this test?
The test? Well, formally, it's called DNA methylation. It's also known as the Horvath clock, Horvath.
Super interesting. It's Inside Tracker was Jill Blunder. I was the founder, possible. I interviewed Jill years ago when he started, when he launched the company. Mm-hmm. I remember I've interviewed him at Le Web in Paris, and he had this, you know, initial idea. I thought, wow, that's interesting. I didn't know he was that Inside Tracker kept growing.
Yeah, it's doing really well. And now they have hundreds of thousands of data points.
Wow.
And so that it's really quite a powerful thing to compare yourself to other people of your age.
Scary. Feels like when I go on the Peloton that I compare myself with the other bikers, and I'm always, you know, like, no, I'm in the middle of it. I see people that I think, wow, how are they doing? David, we still have like 3 minutes. I wanted to close about mindset, because we've been talking about the food and movement and everything you should do, but what is the impact of a good mindset? Is there any impact? Can you track it? Can you measure it? Can you research it? What do you think about?
Mm-hmm. Well, it has been researched by people who are expert, not me, but it's very clear that the societies and villages that do really well for longevity have a couple of advantages. What they do is they have a good social network, so they're taken care of, and they have a lot of mental stimulation. Loneliness will kill you, it seems. And the second that they have is that they have a goal in life, right? You want to be able to get out of bed in the morning and do something that you love if you can. These two things seem to be very important. I really strive to reduce my stress in life. I used to be a very stressed person. Teenage years, I was telling you, it was overwhelmingly stressful. And I've learned to try and focus on the positive, breathe. If I'm panicking about something, go for a walk, get away from the computer. These are skills that you can learn and I think will pay off in the end.
Got it. Fantastic. David, congrats for your book. Longevità is the Italian title. I will add the link in the description of the video. And as soon as I finish our call, I will do the test. I'll let you know if I pass the test or I'm really old already. And most of all, I'll call Warren Buffett saying, Warren, come on, put some billions in the funding, in the research. Is that acceptable? Is that acceptable? Yeah. I'm sure that will be more and more funding, I mean, in the next years. I'm sure about it.
Well, hopefully, especially now that we're having these breakthroughs, I think it's like the Wright brothers 100 years ago. We've shown we can do something that we thought was impossible. Now it's just a question of doing the innovation part of it.
Fantastic. David, congrats. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. It was really interesting. Good luck.
I appreciate the chance.
Bye.